The word Congies is a New England nickname for Congregationalists, those almost unbelievably courageous pilgrims who came to America in 1620 in search of religious freedom. In the nearly four centuries since then, a great many congregational men and women have distinguished themselves, but I would like to pay tribute this morning to three of them whose lives still have an impact on ours. Let's begin with a former minister of First Congregational Church in Akron, Ohio, whose novel, Magnificent Obsession, became a bestseller in the 1930s. Each of Lloyd C. Douglas's 10 novels made it to the bestseller list, and several were number one. Among them were two others you may have read, The Robe and The Big Fisherman. Although six of them became movies, and one was the basis for a television series in the 1950s, few people knew that Douglas was a minister and a Congregationalist. Magnificent Obsession is based on the idea that there is a single verse in the Bible which can transform life if people take it seriously. The plot goes like this. When Dr. Wayne Hudson, despondent over the death of his wife, goes to pick out a marker for her grave, he meets a sculptor who asks him, "How would you like to be the best doctor in this town?" and tells him that he has discovered a simple formula for changing one's life. He invites Dr. Hudson to his home, where, when he picks up a Bible, the doctor immediately says, "Now, if that's it, I don't care to hear about it." The sculptor says that this particular Bible lacks the secret formula, which is found only on one page, because he has removed that page and keeps it somewhere else. When Dr. Hudson insists on knowing what is on the missing page, the sculptor pulls a folded and faded piece of paper from his wallet. He warns the doctor that the formula is dangerous stuff and should be used only to help others and only in absolute secrecy. The formula is based on a principle expressed in the Sermon on the Mount. Beware of practicing your religion before others in order to be seen by them. When you pray, do so privately. When you do good deeds, do it so quietly that your left hand doesn't know what your right hand is doing. The novel shows different people trying out this radical notion of investing in other people in secret and how the experience changes their lives. It's so persuasive that most people who read it are tempted, at least for a while, to put the formula into practice. Douglas fascinates me also because, like myself, he found a home in the congregational way after realizing that his faith had changed so much he could not be comfortable anywhere else. He was influenced by his free-thinking father, who meant to become a Lutheran minister until he failed his ordination exam by admitting that he did not believe unbaptized infants went to hell, and by saying further that hell itself did not fit his idea of a God of infinite love. He also didn't believe in the devil. He thought God would not have created that kind of competition. So he decided to become a lawyer and practiced for several years before he found a Lutheran synod that would ordain him without examination. His son Lloyd recalled that there was always a Lutheran church boss who collided with his father's liberal views and who thought it was wrong for Papa to make people laugh or cry at his stories of real people instead of talking only about shadowy and distant figures in the Bible. It meant that the Douglas family did not stay very long in one place. Young Lloyd did not want to become a minister, but his mother insisted, and after seminary, he served a couple of small Lutheran churches before accepting a call to Washington, D.C. In that larger world, he discovered new ways of looking at biblical history, and within a couple of years, he grew weary of people who wanted to hear only what they had heard all their lives. He announced one day that he simply did not believe some of the things his congregation expected him to say, and that he was resigning. That would probably have been the end of his ministerial career, except for a later friendship with a congregational minister who spoke of that church's openness to new ideas and who convinced him that there was a place for him in ministry after all. After preaching for congregational churches in Michigan and Ohio, Douglas was called to First Congregational Church in Los Angeles, where he served as senior minister for 3 years. The church liked him, except for a few ultra-conservative retirees from the Midwest who knew how a preacher was supposed to sound. So once again, he was under fire, and it was during this time, when he found it impossible to sleep, that he finished the novel Magnificent Obsession. Much to the dismay of most of his congregation, he decided to retire. A decision that made better sense than ever when Magnificent Obsession and a second novel both landed at the same time on the bestseller list. I spent some time last week reading from his sermons and from an Atlantic Monthly article in which he spoke his religious convictions. He won my heart all over again when he began a list of the weaknesses of Protestant churches by saying, they are too noisy. He felt, as I do, that intelligent adults deserve at least 1 hour on Sunday morning when they can worship God and focus on challenging ideas without the constant noise and bathroom journeys common in so many churches. Heretics, by the way, often come into their own after conveniently dying, and it may interest you to know that First Church LA, where a group of hidebound conservatives once met to discuss firing Dr. Douglas while he was away on vacation, will play host next November, nearly 70 years later, to a 3-day seminar to honor their one-time minister. Magnificent Obsession is not a Nobel Prize-winning novel, but the basic idea it builds on would improve anyone's life. I read it when I was very young, and I wish I had practiced it more often with the idealism I felt then. My second congregational great is one of the most illustrious poets in American literature, Emily Dickinson. She grew up attending First Congregational Church in Amherst, Massachusetts, went off for a year to a female seminary, Mount Holyoke, and came back home to spend the rest of her life in a small and rigid world where the church had the very highest authority. Not surprisingly, Dickinson's poetry returns again and again to great religious themes. What is God like? Is there life after death? How, in a world where innocent people suffer, can we say that God is love? On the subject of immortality, she was, like many intelligent people, back and forth. When her father died, she said, "I am glad there is immortality, but would have tested it myself before entrusting him." She was not much comforted by well-meaning friends who were much more certain than she was. After her mother's death, she said, "We don't know where she is, though so many tell us." She loved the wonders of this earth so much that she wrote, "Going to heaven, how dim it sounds." And in the same mood, "I'm glad I don't believe it, for it would stop my breath, and I'd like to look a little more at such a curious earth." People who are as fiercely honest as this great poet understand the tension in her life between faith and doubt. I'm sure one of her favorite people in the New Testament, as he is mine, was the man who came to Jesus one day to confess that same tension, "Lord, I believe, help my unbelief." In the finest tradition of congregational freedom, she thought for herself. When she heard of Theodore Parker, a preacher so unconventional that even the Boston Unitarians said the young man must be silenced, she decided to see for herself. "I never read before what Mr. Parker wrote," she said. "I heard he was poison. Then I like poison very well." She reminds me of how, when I was in high school, our fundamentalist preacher ridiculed Thomas Paine's The Age of Reason. Atheistic poison, he called it. When I went off to college, 500 miles away from home, it was the first book I checked out of the college library, and like Miss Dickinson, found good sense in what my preacher had called poison. As for God and heaven, Emily Dickinson found both all around her. You know the famous lyric, "Some keep the Sabbath going to church, I keep it staying at home, with a bobolink for a chorister and an orchard for a dome." In another stanza about places on this earth as beautiful as the Salmon River, she says, "God preaches, a noted clergyman, and the sermon is never long. So instead of going to heaven at last, I'm going all along." If you've ever been irritated by a glib, smooth preacher who was positive about everything, you would like the poem in which she describes such a man and then says, "What confusion would cover the innocent Jesus to meet so enabled a man?" Enabled. Who but a poet could say so much in one word? And which one of us having lost a loved one, could fail to relate to these lines. The bustle in a house the morning after death is solemnest of industries enacted upon earth. The sweeping up of the heart and putting love away we shall not want to use again until eternity. And what better way to describe how even the deepest grief slowly fades into another season of life than to link it with the gradual passing of summer into autumn. Listen to this lovely line. As imperceptibly as grief, the summer lapsed away. Both events happened to us. A good poet has the perfect words for speaking of them. There comes a day when suddenly you know you are not grieving so much. There comes a day when suddenly you say to yourself, summer has gone. She puts them together. She is a genius. Jesus made graceful modesty a high priority in his kingdom of right relationships. And for graceful modesty, how about the way Emily Dickinson addresses a literary critic to whom she sent a few of her poems? Are you too deeply occupied to say if my verse is alive? All we remember of this particular man is that he suggested she might improve her poetry before trying to publish it, polish it a bit, and make it a little more conventional. She wisely decided to trust her own genius and gave up on the idea of publication. It was just as well. She was too far ahead of her time to find an audience. I am happy to remind you this morning to count among the treasures of your congregational past this incomparable poet. My final witness grew up in Massachusetts and was saturated from childhood with the ideas and the spirit of congregationalism. Catherine Lee Bates taught at Wellesley all her life as a professor of English literature, and like Emily Dickinson, was filled with a passionate love of freedom and with a mystic rapture at the beauty of the world around her. She wrote books, articles, poetry, and two of her poems, set to music, became beloved and beautiful Christian hymns. In one of them, she asks not for more beauty, since we are flooded with beauty everywhere, but for keener vision to see it in all the changing garments of earth and sky. One verse says, stars and rainbows are God's clothing, sunlight and shadow moving on the hills, meadows holy where the feet of God walk, the clear running brook filled with God's laughter. She needed only the right inspiration to write the hymn that for millions of us has become the most beloved of all our national anthems. And she got it when she decided to take a trip west 100 years ago. When she stopped in Chicago for the Columbian Exposition, she was thrilled by a showcase Snow White city built on a Chicago lagoon. That image would come to mind a few days later when she expressed the hope that one day the alabaster cities of America would gleam undimmed by human tears. She knew that day that much of the Chicago around her was dirty and dimmed by the anguish of thousands of people unable to live decent lives. 4 miles northwest of where she stood that day lay the stockyards, in whose stench and blood thousands of blacks and immigrant workers toiled long hours for miserable pay and went home to sleep in wretched slums. In just a few short years, Upton Sinclair would expose that horror in a powerful novel of social injustice called The Jungle. 6 miles north of the exposition's fairy tale White City lay the black ghetto, one day to be held up in horror in Richard Wright's first novel, Native Son. And 4 miles to the south, she could see the smoke of the steel industry, expanding with utter disregard of humane working conditions in plants where people spent 12-hour working days with no one monitoring the risks to life and limb that were all around them. So when Catherine Bates wrote her great hymn that year, she was no sentimental patriot, blind to the unfulfilled promise of America. Her great song is in considerable part a passionate prayer in behalf of her beloved country. God, mend thine every flaw, she pleads, and crown thy good with brotherhood from sea to shining sea. From Chicago, her trip to the American West continued. Of her brief stop at the fair, she wrote, "With that quickened and deepened sense of America, we went on, my New England eyes delighting in the wind-waved gold of the vast wheat fields." That image from the Great Plains gave her a few days later the opening line of her hymn, "O beautiful for spacious skies, for amber waves of grain," and her jubilation at the beauty and vastness of America climaxed when she climbed Pike's Peak and gazed in wonder at purple mountain majesties stretching endlessly, and came down to finish the hymn within hours in Colorado Springs. The pilgrim feet, she mentions in her song, are not only those congregational ones that landed at Plymouth Rock, but are the feet as well of thousands and thousands of pioneers, pilgrims who trekked across the Alleghenies, the Great Plains, the Rockies, all the way to the Golden Gate. This college English professor had seen in the snow-white buildings of a Chicago fair an image of what America might become. And in the endless wheat fields of Kansas and Nebraska, and in the soaring majesty of the Rockies, she marveled at how God had already blessed the country she so passionately loved. It would have pleased her to know that her verses will be sung all over America when we celebrate our freedom on this coming Thursday.